ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Charleston, Mattoon, and surrounding communities, with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Dr. Amy Rosenstein, professor of special education at Eastern Illinois University. But first, disability news for the week of June 19th, 2023. The Biden administration is encouraging all states to be certain that they aren't ending Medicaid benefits in error, while more than a million beneficiaries have already been removed from the rolls. U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra asked states to use every tool at their disposal to keep people who should qualify from losing coverage. Becerra wrote in his letter, quote, "I am deeply concerned with the number of people unnecessarily losing coverage, especially those who appear to have lost coverage for avoidable reasons that state Medicaid offices have the power to prevent or mitigate. Given the high number of people losing coverage due to administrative processes, I urge you to review your state's currently elected flexibilities and consider going further to take up existing and new policy options that we have offered to protect eligible individuals and families from procedural termination," end quote. Under the public health emergency during the COVID pandemic, states could receive extra federal money for Medicaid if they agreed to not drop most people from the program. Now that the emergency ended in May, states are reevaluating eligibility for everyone on Medicaid. KFF is a nonprofit that researches health policy research. Their data says that states across the country have disenrolled more than a million beneficiaries. In many cases, benefits are ending because the participants didn't complete the renewal process, with so-called procedural disenrollments accounting for about 89% of Medicaid terminations in some states. According to Zoe Gross, Director of Advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, quote, "These aren't people who were carefully reviewed and found ineligible. They're people who weren't able to complete a paperwork requirement. This suggests a rushed process that didn't do enough to try and reach the most vulnerable beneficiaries, including our community. We are concerned that many people who have lost their Medicaid coverage may not even know it yet. If they miss notices and paperwork about renewal, for example, if those were sent to an old or incorrect address, they may not realize that they had to complete paperwork and may not find out they've lost coverage until they seek medical care and are denied," end quote. Becerra's letter listed a number of steps that states can take to make certain that eligible beneficiaries don't unnecessarily lose coverage, suggesting that states lengthen the time for the renewal process to a full year, and by automatically renewing people who qualify for programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Also, Becerra advised that states work with managed care programs and use data from the U.S. Postal Service to update people's contact information. Becerra said that his agency will use its oversight authority to ask states to pause procedural terminations if they feel it is needed. David Goldfarb, Director of Policy at the ARC, advised that people with developmental disabilities contact their state Medicaid office to find out when and how they will be notified about the renewal process, and to carefully check for any mail or email from their state Medicaid office and respond accordingly. Goldfarb said, that people with disabilities should also be certain that they are in compliance with their state's rules about how much money they can earn or save while receiving Medicaid benefits. Goldfarb said, and remember, quote, you can request a full hearing if you believe the state has wrongly determined you ineligible, end quote. For the first time since the pandemic, thousands of athletes with developmental disabilities from around the world will come together this week in Berlin, Germany, to compete in various sports like swimming, tennis, and gymnastics, and many more. The week-long event is expected to draw over 7,000 athletes with and without intellectual disabilities from 190 countries to compete in 26 different sports, supported by more than 3,000 coaches and 20,000 volunteers. Special Olympics World Games usually happens every 2 years, alternating between summer and winter sports, but the last competition was held in 2019 in Abu Dhabi. The World Winter Games, scheduled to be held in Russia this past winter, was canceled as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The opening ceremony of the World Games in Berlin will air Saturday at 2 p.m. Central Time on ABC. Also, ESPN will air more than 220 hours of live competition coverage on their streaming platforms, ESPN Plus and ESPN 3, and that will happen throughout the week. A two-hour Best of Special Olympics World Games Berlin 2023 will air on ABC on July 2nd at noon Central Time. And finally, Donald Triplett, the first person to be diagnosed with autism, has died at the age of 89. Triplett had been identified as case one in a 1943 paper, which was the first to explore the concept of autism. In recent years, Triplett came to prominence after the publication of a book and documentary, both titled In a Different Key, which focused on his experiences. Triplett was institutionalized as a child for a short time based on the advice of doctors, but his parents ultimately found experts to help them understand what made their son different. He went on to be a fixture in his hometown of Forest, Mississippi, and worked for 65 years at a bank where his father was the primary shareholder. According to the bank's CEO, Alan Breland, quote, he was in his own world, but if you gave him 2 3-digit numbers, he could multiply them faster than you could get the answer on a calculator. He also said that Triplett liked to golf and travel often. Triplett was a graduate of Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. John Donovan and Karen Zucker, who wrote the book and made the documentary In a Different Key, said they visited Triplett just days before he died last Thursday. In a Facebook post, they wrote, quote, his ending was peaceful. He died at home in Forest, Mississippi, surrounded by love and family, which of course was the story of his whole life, end quote. And that's the news for this week.
In the meantime, in between time, let us make time to make it right.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nice-Wonder, and I'm joined today in the studio by Amy Rosenstein, who I remember from way back in when I was getting my master's degree at U of I. She and I were students at the same time, and we just ran into each other fairly recently, and I said, hey, be on my show. And so she agreed to do that. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's start out by you just letting everyone know and catching me up on everything that you've been doing lately.
As you said, obviously I was at University of Illinois in their special education program as a doctoral student. And then after completing that program, I took a tenure line position at Eastern Illinois University, where I have been ever since in the Department of Special Education there.
And what are the things that you teach there?
So primarily I teach courses in their teacher preparation program for special education teachers. And over the years, that has been a number of different courses. But one course that I teach most often is a collaborative class. It's how teachers work with other other teachers, other parents, and just try to do things that make the partnerships between schools and families better, easier, more productive. And then my other area really is curriculum adaptation, so curriculum studies and curriculum adaptation, and then how to change what we do in our classrooms to make learning opportunities more accessible to students with disabilities in a variety of different ways.
Mm-hmm. And so you've had experience at both the University of Illinois and Eastern now for, I mean,
like 16 years.
Yeah,
it's been a long time.
So what are the big differences that you could describe between the two programs that you've participated in?
The University of Illinois is primarily a research institution, and the teacher preparation program there in special education, while small, is still a very good program that that educates teachers in the same or similar way to what's kind of required everywhere else. But there is a little bit different focus of maybe the faculty who are there, mm-hmm. and that they are, they do a lot with research grants and those kinds of things. So their time is spent a little bit differently than what you might find at EIU. So in our program at EIU, we also do teacher preparation. Our programs are a little bit larger. Our primary focus is on teacher preparation, and so like all of our time and energy is kind of dedicated to that purpose. So, mm-hmm. So the teaching that we do in our classes is while it's research and evidence based, and our students are responsible for knowing and understanding how to read research and use research and collect their own data and make educational decisions based on that data. Our job as faculty is to ensure that they do that and do that well, and that everything that we sort of do lends itself to that. So we, for instance, at EIU, we teach our courses, we develop our partnerships with our community schools and in our cities and nearby regions, and we do our own supervision. So if I teach a class on curriculum adaptation, for instance, I identify the teachers in the community that are appropriate to work with the students based on what their needs are and what they're doing in their classrooms, and then I develop that relationship. My students are placed in those classrooms, and then I do the supervision in those placements. So my students get me in class, and then they get me during those practical field experiences. And then the research that our students do, we meaning me and my colleagues, we will sort of wrap around them and help them learn and develop and grow as sort of teacher practitioners. So they, sort of research teacher practitioners, like in their own classroom. So they know what they're handling. And so then our research kind of becomes a part of our learning and understanding about how teachers are prepared and how to best do that, and then what students are doing in classrooms. And it's more sort of real time. And then we also do a lot of service in our communities. And so a lot of the service projects that we do as faculty serve school and community agencies in our area. So we're sort of more directly involved with the schools, the families, the sort of community groups that are there in and around our area.
So what kind of groups are you involved with then as special ed faculty?
There's a number of different organizations that we interact with. Certainly we partner with our schools. Mm-hmm. And then if they have special projects that they're looking to grow and develop, we work with them. We also do some work with student groups on campus that are parts of national organizations. Mm-hmm. So our Student Council for Exceptional Children has quite a following. And then we also have faculty members who support and supervise and are faculty sponsors for things like Best Buddies. We partner with Special Olympics. And so we do a lot with recruiting volunteers and helping to organize some of the events in and around the area. So everything from the family festival that happens in the fall to Polar Plunge that happens in the winter to spring games at EIU in the late spring, we're involved with those groups. But we're also involved with groups like EASY, which is the Eastern Illinois area special education
co-op.
And so we have activities and things that we do with them. Some of our faculty are directors on various boards, including like Camp New Hope, so and CTF. And so we have a lot of
CTF is Charleston Transitional Facility, which is a provider sort of like in this area as Developmental Services Center is, right?
Right. So sort of it's somewhat regional. It's mostly in the Charleston area, though.
Yeah. But yeah. I think they have some group homes and so forth in the Chicago area, too.
Yeah. So we have a number of groups that we do work with and interact with. And
so these are actually faculty that are working with the groups. It's not. So what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, if you take classes at the University of Illinois, oftentimes you don't even see the professor or not very much. A grad assistant might teach the class. That sounds like it's not happening so much at Eastern.
No. So we so in the Department of Special Education at EIU, we do not have what we call clinical faculty. So so at the University of Illinois, and I don't pretend to be an expert on the structure, the makeup of their department and how it sort of functions, but they do have professors that teach classes and they do research and they, you know, bring in a ton of grant money and do a lot of great research that then a faculty like me at a teaching university will take and then use and then and disseminate. But at U of I, I also know that they also have clinical faculty. So that clinical faculty might be the ones that sort of develop the practica and then do supervision. And so while students might be doing assignments for a professor in a class, and they are, you know, getting real-time data in classrooms, that those field experiences are often supervised by clinical faculty who are not necessarily the individuals who are teaching the classes.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the challenges that special education has been facing in recent years, and maybe it came before COVID, I'm not sure, but I know that there have been shortages of special education teachers. Have you had that issue brought up to you in your program? Has that been a local concern for school districts in the area? And what are some of the, are there any incentives that are being offered by districts in order to get some special education staff hired?
Yeah, so this is something that actually has been around for quite some time. I mean, in special education, well, not just special education, there's a number of areas in the field of teacher prep and then in teaching that historically have had difficulty recruiting and keeping teachers in various positions. Special education is definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, special education as a field really didn't develop until the early 70s, right, with the inception of Public Law 94-142, which was what we now call IDEA. Like, it's had various names sort of over the years, but this is the primary law that sort of all of us kind of follow. And even early on, as early as the late 70s, it was clear that what was sort of needed was this sort of workforce development, if you will. We hear that term often now, but it's something that's been around for a long time, right? So this workforce development where you have to identify people who are trained, educated to do certain types of activities and or have specific types of knowledge in order to perform their job and sort of do it well, right? So so that is really where special education departments or the inception of special education departments as departments in higher education sort of kind of came into being. It's sort of how this developed. Prior to that, it would have been, there would have been teacher preparation programs that would have been primarily targeted for curriculum instruction is what they would be called, and they would be preparation for what we sort of identify as general education teachers. So these are general education teachers being basically like every other category but special education. I'm laughing, it's not funny. The distinction there, like really there really should be more collaboration and crossover between those two, but for a variety of reasons, there's sort of a general education category and a special education category. And so
self-containment happens at the college level too, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it comes early. So sadly, I mean, really that's true. It's very sad. So, for me, my experience is a little bit different because I was a general education teacher before I was a special education teacher. So for me,
what did you teach previously before you became special ed?
Well, so my first master's is in curriculum instruction, and
your first
master's. Yeah, I just started there. Yeah, that's something else about special education teachers. Eventually, we just end up with so many degrees, and it's funny not. Not really funny, but it does happen, and primarily because we're curious by nature, I think, and we are always trying to learn more and prepare ourselves more and be better and do better for our students.
It's like you've got so many different students with so many unusual needs. That you have to address, and so I see that.
Yeah. So for me, So initially I was a general education teacher, and my endorsements were actually in science, social science, and art. I had sort of an extensive background in a number of different areas. And so when I went through my teacher preparation program and then sort of completed that first teaching certificate, we were still doing this sort of categorical kinds of endorsements, right? So my initial certification was K through 9 with science, social science, and arts. Those were the things that I was basically certified to teach. And I found when I was teaching that initially, I had actually not intended to go into a classroom. Like I had wanted to do museum education. I wanted to be this person that created resources for teachers so that they could use them to expand the knowledge and skills of kids in art and in science. Like that was really why my background is so bizarrely varied. Because I don't just see art as art; I see art as a kind of science. So anyway, I had this kind of opportunity then at some point to work with individuals with disabilities. So I taught in a middle school. My first job was as a social studies teacher in a middle school, and I was on one side of the hall, and there was a fantastic teacher on the other side of the hall, and she had a self-contained classroom for students who had severe emotional issues. So we decided at some point that we were just going to kind of take over the hallway. So she opened her door and opened my door. And we had this really great sort of crossover in our classrooms where we would sort of co-teach before co-teaching was like really a thing. So this is like the 90s, right? And so our students were sort of integrated with each other, but we sort of found that when all of our students were together and there were two of us, we could do much more interesting things with our classrooms, right? And so what I sort of found after that was that it was really hard for me to just kind of go back into this general education classroom and not have this sort of rich variety in styles and personalities and learning, right, with people. And so I then started looking at working with individuals with disabilities, and actually took a job in a residential school. And while I was there, I got had more and more questions than I sort of knew what to do with. And so I had at some point realized that, oh, you know, I'm like right here at the University of Illinois, and they have these great researchers here who work with individuals with disabilities like all the time. So I invited a couple of them to come into my class and to help me sort of better understand what was going on with the students that were in my classrooms. And that was Dr. Jim Halley and mm-hmm. Dr. Adele Ranzaglia, who were super fantastic with me and taught me so much. And so then, you know, they were like, hey, so maybe you should just start taking some classes, right? So so that's how I then ended up getting my first master's in special, you know, like in doing it in special education. And so that, well, actually it was my second master's. So that's sort of how I kind of came into that. So I saw as an individual sort of this crossover, this necessary sort of need between general education and special education. But I felt, you know, even with all the knowledge that I had, even when I finished my program and I took my first job as a special education teacher, I sort of went into this thinking, like, it's not like I don't know what I'm doing, right? Like, I've got this experience. I've been in these various classrooms. Like, I've had this opportunity to work with world-class researchers. And still, you know, the job was challenging. There's a lot that goes on in these particular
And so you're classrooms. Still learning all the time.
Really all the time. And so I continued, obviously, to learn as a professional, and I had a lot of personal growth in there, too. And so for me, now when I think about this, you know, how do we educate teachers? I listen to people talk about it, and I'm not an expert on, you know, teacher preparation or the policies related to labor statistics. Like, that's not really my area, but I do obviously read and keep up with it. But I'm often sort of surprised when I look at that information and people talk about and or have so much to say about all the things that teachers are or are not doing that are right or wrong. And they talk about, you know, and shortage and retention are not really the same thing, right? So mm-hmm. I'll come to that in a second. But I think about...
Oh, we have like 2 minutes. So,
oh, yes. I should probably get me. So, so I think about those things, and I want people to sort of step back and think about, okay, you know, when you talk about shortage and teacher shortage, you know, there's this... progression of and or need for should growth of this field. And so there's, you know, always going to be sort of openings, right? The more we know the more schools know and the more population changes, the greater the need. But it's not really, I would say, you know, any different than any, you know, other up and coming sort of job area. But, you know, what's happened now is that we have this sort of growth of jobs and need for it, and we are not keeping up with the demand for it, and that's what creates the shortage.
Right,
in terms
of the disability population keeps increasing as well.
Right,
which includes kids.
Yes.
So if people want more information, are thinking, well, maybe I ought to come back to school and get my degree in special education. How do they get in touch with? You know, what's the process for going to Eastern Illinois University?
So there's a couple of different options. Obviously, we have an undergraduate program, but we also have a program for students who already have an undergraduate degree in another area, but are seeking what's called a post-bac. And then we also have master's programs for people who do have undergraduate degrees in special education but want to know.
Is all this on a website somewhere where it's all explained?
Yes. So you can go to Eastern Illinois University's homepage. You can do a search within that for College of Education or Department of Special Education, and you will find information there all about us.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Amy Rosenstein, professor at Eastern Illinois University in Special Education. It was okay. A pleasure having you.
Thanks.
And you are tuned to W. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.